been talking about how much of a mitzvah it is for a man to have relations with his wife. You know, when we have mitzvot in Judaism, we often make blessings over them. So what's the mitzvah? What's the blessing we say over having relations with one's wife? You're exactly right. There is none. So when I was asked this question many years ago, I was given two beautiful answers as to why there isn't one. On the one hand, you could say, if this is the most exquisite type of pleasure possible, same way we make a blessing over food or drink, we should make a blessing over sex. We don't. If we say it's because of the mitzvah, we also don't. So the halachic reason that we don't make a bracha over this mitzvah is because you never make a blessing over a mitzvah that requires someone else's participation. Give tzedakah, you don't make a blessing because it requires someone else's participation. Perhaps the reason we don't make a blessing over the pleasure is because when we eat or we drink, the pleasure's from taking. When a couple has relations, the pleasure's from giving. And we never make a blessing when we give pleasure, only when we take it. So I want to end by discussing the Jewish laws of family holiness. It says in the Torah that when a woman has her period, a couple has to separate. They can't have intimate relations until she has immersed herself in a ritual bath known as a mikvah. Today, the way these laws are practiced is from the time a woman anticipates her period until a week after it's finished, she and her husband don't have a physical relationship. At the end of that period of time, she physically cleans herself and she immerses in a ritual bath, and after that they can resume having a physical relationship. There are certain halachot that surround the kinds of separations that people have during this time. One of the separations that are observed is that a wife may not do her usual wifely things for her husband in the usual manner. For example, the Talmud says that a series of things that a wife must do for her husband, regardless of how many servants she has to do everything else for her, is she is supposed to serve him his food and pour him drinks and turn down his bed or make his bed, and you'll love this one, ladies, to wash his feet. Today we don't do the washing the feet and we don't do things that would make a woman feel demeaned, but the idea of serving food and drink is something that women don't do when they're in a state of nida, which is a state of separation from their husbands. A lot of times people misinterpret what these laws are all about. One of the misinterpretations comes from the idea that a woman who is nida is in a state of tuma. Tumah is usually misinterpreted and mistranslated as ritual impurity or something along the lines of being contaminated. Right? We're nuclear waste dumps, ladies. In fact, the word tameh means spiritually blocked. And the word tahor, which is usually translated as holy or ritually pure, means spiritually unblocked, a spiritual free flow. When a woman becomes nida, what God is telling us is that there's a spiritual blockage that is preventing her from accessing certain levels of purity, of holiness. There are seven different kinds of situations that can make a person tameh or spiritually blocked. If you look at them, they all involve some contact with death, touching a certain dead animal, when a man has a seminal emission, when a woman has a baby, when a person becomes a mitzora, which is mistranslated as leper, I'm not going to get into what mitzora really is, and when a person contacts a dead body or comes in contact with death. What all of these things have in common in some form or another is either there is contact with actual death or something that had potential life did not come to fruition. When a woman has her period, the egg that could have developed into a human being dies, and potential life is lost. Judaism tells us at these points, when a person becomes tameh or ritually blocked, we need to separate ourselves a little bit and use that time for introspecting and put ourselves through a process of reconnecting to God so that we can fully actualize our spirituality. When a couple is married and a woman becomes nida, what's essentially happening to the woman is as follows. Her body says to her, you are capable of creating life. It wasn't created this month. Realize that everything in this physical world is limited and is destined to die and decay. The husband and wife separate at that very time, that her body's teaching them that everything physical is limited. Hopefully they'll use the next 12 days or 2 weeks as an opportunity to work on their marriage, to improve their communication, to develop avenues of relating to one another that can make deposits in their emotional relationship. There's a story about a couple who got engaged. And when they got engaged, the fiancé wrote his female fiancé a check for $1 million. You can imagine, she was overjoyed. Until she went to the bank and tried to cash it and found there was no money to cash it. Many people today have marriages that are emotionally bankrupt. Even if they're having a physical relationship, there are no emotional deposits to draw upon. These 2 weeks of abstinence every month give couples an opportunity to put emotional deposits into their relationship account. So when they have that physical relationship and they resume intimacy, it's like cashing that check for $1 million because the bank account is very full. When I mentioned before about the wife not doing things for her husband in the customary way she would normally do them, one of the worst things that happens in marriage is people grow tired of each other. They take each other for granted. Imagine every month you're reminded of how much your wife does for you and how much your husband does for you, and you stop taking them for granted and begin to appreciate the little things that are part and parcel of daily life. One of the most difficult things in marriage is maintaining a sense of intimacy and appreciation for the mundane. I remember when I was a child, again a teenager, one of the most exciting things that people could do, ready for this, was to hold hands. I mean, nowadays even sex isn't exciting. In those days, you know, we would come into high school and we'd say, so, did you do it? And in those days it meant, did you hold hands with the guy you've been dating for the last 2 months? Did it finally happen? And holding hands was so intimate. It was so exciting. Forget about kissing. I mean, that was over the top. I remember movies from the 50s where the most exciting thing you could do if you were going steady was to share an ice cream soda, sip from the same beverage. You know, it's so sad that we're so bombarded with sex everywhere, that these tiny little things that used to mean so much have been reduced to nothingness. And so perhaps our sages were great romantics. And they said, you know something? If every month you're reminded of the fact that it can be intimate to have a cup of coffee together, to share a meal together, to touch each other, to spend time together with nobody infringing on your relationship. When you can't have it, remind yourselves that when you can, you should have it. And so I'm going to suggest that all of us in our marriages should use these opportunities to take the little things in life and make them special. I'm going to end by telling you a beautiful prayer that many women say before they immerse themselves in the mikvah, that I think so beautifully encapsulates what Jewish marriage is all about. May it be your will, Lord our God, that your divine presence rest between my husband and myself. May your holy name be unified through us and cause a spirit of purity and holiness to enter our hearts. Distance me from all bad thoughts and fantasies and give my husband and me pure and clean souls. Let neither of us desire anyone else, but let me desire my husband, and let him desire me. And let me feel that no man in the world is better, more handsome, or more gracious than my husband. And so should I seem to him, that no woman in the world is more beautiful, gracious, and appropriate for him than me. Let him think only about me and no one else. As it is said, therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and cleave unto his wife. And may it be your will, Lord our God, that our union be beautiful and proper, with love, unity, peace, and friendship, according to the laws of Moses and Judaism, with proper fear of heaven and fear of sin. Let our union result in healthy, deserving children who are righteous, perfect, and upright, whose bodies will not be damaged or lacking, and who will have no affliction, plague, sickness, disease, pain, trouble, or failing, but only goodness all the days of their lives. Let our union be blessed, as it says, your wife shall be like a fruitful vine in your house, your children like planted olive trees around your table. Our marriage should be one where my husband is happier with me than with all of the good things that he has in the world. We should have no anger, quarreling, contention, or jealousy between us. Only love, unity, peace, friendship, patience, and doing good to God's creatures. Our souls, spirits, and bodies should form a union that will allow holiness and purity to flow in thought, speech, and action as befits proper Jews. Our union should accord with the Jewish laws of holiness, with success and blessing of heaven above and of the deep below, blessings of the breasts and the womb, a union of holy and pure seed, good and beautiful, sweet and acceptable. I'm going to stop my talk here and open the floor for questions.
Yeshiva been established in Canada or North America or Israel to your knowledge?
The question was, have any of Rav's yeshivas been established anywhere that I know of? I will tell you that to the best of my knowledge, there are very, very few yeshivas that, or any yeshivas that teach it in a formal way. There are some yeshivas in Jerusalem that I know spend a year preparing the boys to get married. And they cover the gamut of what needs to be taught, either in group classes or as it gets close to a boy's wedding, in individual classes about how to treat one's wife, not only in the bedroom, but out of the bedroom. I was asked by Chavi if there are any books that I can recommend. Of course, I recommend my own book, Guide for the Romantically Perplexed. And I wrote the book for several reasons, one of which is I hope that it would make its way into the yeshiva world. I think it's one of the books that people take out in a brown paper bag, but it has actually made its way into the yeshiva world, and it's been something that I think has helped a great deal of couples, great number of couples. Yes?
I understand that there's a clinic in Netanya where the boys from the yeshiva who are completely lost when they have to have sex in marriage. And there's a lot of problems that are happening there. And this clinic is really helping them because they know nothing when they start to get married. You know, they've come straight out of the yeshiva. They're 19 years old or 18 years old, and they know from nothing.
I don't know about the places in Netanya, but I do know that in Jerusalem they have trained hundreds of counselors to help couples, both individually, men and women, as well as couples, to deal with the sexual issues in marriage.
Because they don't teach it in the yeshivot.
I don't think that anytime soon they're going to teach it en masse anywhere, but on a one-on-one basis there are some places that it is being taught. Yes.
You speak so beautifully about the relations, the sexual relations between men and women. However, our children today are being socialized to stay as far apart from the opposite sex as possible. Can you say something about that?
The question is not something I'm hearing for the first time. I remember when I was in NCSY at age 14 or 15 that I was talking to one of the boys about how he felt about keeping the girls and boys separate in some of the communities that some people were going back to. He said he told me a story about a man who decided that he wanted to keep his son out of the way of women. So he raised his boy in a room and he never saw the outside world. And finally, at the age of 18, he unlocked the door and he let his son out. And the son walked down the street and he said to his father, "See that? I don't know what it is, but I like it." I think that more importantly than how much boys and girls socialize when they're teenagers or even younger than teenagers is the kind of relationship somebody's parents have with one another and the kind of relationships that they have with other people. I think that if children are raised seeing a husband and wife who are their parents, who have a loving, nice relationship with one another, and they live with that for many years, that gives them tremendous tools to have a proper marriage. One of the biggest problems I have with what goes on today is not just that boys and girls are being separated, but that boys are going off to yeshiva by the time they're 12 and 14 years old. They're living in dormitories where someone picks up after them or doesn't pick up after them, where they see a rosh yeshiva, they see very few couples, they see very little family life, and they're not shown models of what a couple is supposed to look like. So more importantly than the fact that they're separated is the fact that they're not seeing models where they are of what a normal marriage looks like. And unfortunately, many of the people that are their teachers are either not relating to their wives in a nice way in front of them, or they're not seeing any relationship between them, because when they're in yeshiva, there is no relationship with the wife much of the time. I remember some very beautiful stories that were told about some of the Gedolim in Jerusalem who had extraordinary relationships with their wives. While it was well known that the rabbis had extraordinary relationships with their wives, I'm not sure how many of the Bacharim saw that in enough magnitude to teach them what it was really supposed to be like to have that kind of relationship with their wives. Your question is very well founded, and unfortunately I don't have good answers to address the problem. When I wrote my book, which used to be called Beyond Bashir, it's now called Guide to the Romantically Perplexed, it came out about almost 10 years ago. My hope was that there would be a number of people in yeshivas who would embrace the book, would recommend it to Bachurim who were getting married, and teach them a framework for having marriage. It never happened. What tends to happen in all these situations is when I give classes about marriage, when I give classes about intimacy, 90% of the people who come are women. 10% of the guys, it's great, but usually they're guys who are already doing these things anyway and they're already sensitive anyway. And when I suggest that people buy the book, it's 90% of the time the women are buying the book and they're trying to get their boyfriends, husbands to read it. So I don't have good solutions to some of these sociological problems. I agree with you. There are some major problems out there. Yes.
The sentence about, and you thought it was a very pivotal thing about how much does a woman want to give or to whom she should choose to give everything. In some way that seems to invalidate trying to find someone so extremely special to whom you want to give. It seems to sort of take the hook off of him and him being wonderful, but it's just that she has to give. You know, I kind of didn't like the idea of having to give if you happen to marry someone who is like a schnook, then it's sort of, well, how much do you want to give to this relationship? It doesn't sort of examine his part in being a wonderful guy to whom you want to give.
The assumption is that finding someone that you can give to doesn't mean finding a schnook that you can give to. It means finding someone who can really appreciate and reciprocate what you're giving. And so it's assumed that part of that means finding a mensch. I don't recommend women finding someone that they give to and the guy does absolutely nothing in the relationship. Presumably, she's also able to receive what he can give so that she can make him feel valued and respected for what he can give and he can make her feel loved for what she can provide.
Okay, and can I just ask one more quick question? About, oh, no?
One more question.
That's it.
Okay, then I'll go.
I've heard some rabbis say that finding your soulmate, quote-unquote, is ridiculous. I just wondered what you had to say.
Unfortunately, I think that many of these people are expressing their own feelings and they're projecting onto others what their own experiences and their relationships. I have had the, I guess I'll call it the pleasure, of knowing rabbis who have such incredible marriages that they can't understand why everybody else is struggling so much. And there's some rabbis who are so cynical about marriage because they themselves have not been able to have what I would call a successful marriage. So just to add one last line before we stop, I think that for many people the task in being single is to keep from getting jaded, not necessarily to get sage advice from so many people. And if people are giving you advice like that, either it means that you're going to the wrong people or you're misinterpreting what they're really trying to get across, which sometimes means don't think that everything's going to be perfect when you find the right person. The relationship still takes a lot of working on.
Thank you very much, Lisa. It really was wonderful, and I know that everybody...